Good morning, Kevin.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very, very good. Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. I've been writing a column in the New Republic these days, and I do blogging heads fairly frequently.
And I'm Kevin Williamson. I'm the deputy managing editor at National Review and the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Socialism. And I do blogging heads not all that frequently. And I usually forget how to work.
It's fun to
software.
Do. It's addictive.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun.
So
what exactly is
the
Roosevelt Institute anyway?
Roosevelt Institute is a think tank. It's a kind of complicated organization. It's the nonprofit arm of the FDR Library in Hyde Park, New York. All the presidential libraries have some form of institute or foundation connected to them that supports research and activities at the library. We've also, in the last couple years, we started up something called the Four Freedom Center. I've only been there for about 5 or 6 months. The Four Freedom Center is kind of a think tank element with a fair number of economists. Joe Stiglitz is affiliated with us. We did a lot of work on financial regulatory reform issues, as well as other, you know, kind of with a base around economic issues, and have a number of fellows and public programs and so forth. And there's also a terrific program. The third component of the Roosevelt Institute is called the Roosevelt Campus Network, which is a terrific program on 300 colleges and universities that is students who want to work on policy issues, often very local issues, but coming together around some national issues. Really tremendous.
Gotcha.
Program. So that's the Roosevelt Institute.
So what do you think
National
about
Review? National Review needs no introduction, right?
Exactly. So what do you think about Occupy Wall Street?
Well, you know, it's one of those things I think I've written some things about it that I kind of regret. It's one of those things for a liberal like me, and I use the word liberal in the traditional sense of somebody who would, you know, if it was the 60s, I would not necessarily have been the first out onto the barricades. You know, a liberal is not a radical, in other words. And so I had some ambivalence about it at first. I had the classic liberal reaction of, you got to actually say something about what it is you actually want to see in the world. And I thought it was very interesting that there were so many things that I'm aware of, wasn't really participating in them, things that I'm aware of, like there's this organization called National People's Action, for example. There were a whole bunch of things that were trying to capture this kind of energy, often involving people who actually had been, you know, the really most direct victims of the financial crisis, people who had been foreclosed on or whose communities had been devastated by foreclosure, that did similar kind of activism. I mean, some of these groups, when they sat on the front yards of the houses of Federal Reserve Board governors until they got meetings, and they got meetings, and they had demands. But none of that got any of the attention that Occupy Wall Street has gotten. So it's interesting that this thing, which is, you know, it's not funded in any of the normal ways that I'm familiar with. It's not structured in the normal ways I'm familiar with. It doesn't have demands. And I've come to understand that, like, not having demands is part of the strength of it, because you're not narrowly organized, and you're not fighting around those demands, and you're really trying to paint a different vision of what it is we should be looking at. I kind of get it. Not having demands also means that succeeding just means getting some attention and continuing. So by that standard, they've succeeded. They can't be judged by, you know, whether their demands are met or not. So it's fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating, and I think that the attention, it does remind me of early Tea Party, where you might say those are, you know, I don't know who are those people. They seem like, you know, a familiar set of crackpots, but actually were able to form the base of something that then actually became a much stronger conservative movement. I know there's a lot of argument about whether there's really ideological overlap with the Tea Party or not, but I think there's certainly, you know, each has learned from the other as in terms of style. So there's a fair amount of that. So, you know, I'm kind of like growing to love it. And there's another element I want to talk about a little bit later, which is that conception of the 99% that they've kind of put into the marketplace of ideas. What do you think about it?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of time down there over the last couple of weeks.
And I haven't, because I'm down in Washington. I was only up briefly in New York.
Right, you're in the permanently occupied city.
Right.
So, you know, you've got your usual disturbing collection of Socialist Worker Party, American Communist Party, CPUSA, all those sorts of explicitly socialist and communist organizations down there who do a lot of the, you know, nuts and bolts, backbone kind of work. And, of course, they show up at every event of this sort. They were at all the anti-war
protests.
And so do
protests. The Rushites and everything else. I mean, that's just what happens.
Yeah, they're anti-war protests. They're, you know, the Seattle WTO things. Although I do think that they, if the thing has a core, at least in terms of people with an ideological motivation, they're it. But then you've also got, you know, sort of a large collection of, you know, sort of aimless riffraff who intuit that something is not quite right in the world. And I think they're correct about that. But they don't understand the nature of their own problem, I think. They don't understand the nature of their own complaint. And they have a really crude, flat earth view of the economy, of this sort of, you know, zero-sum games, pie that gets sliced up in various ways, and no real conception of the actual dynamics of work in an economy like ours. And, you know, it's funny to me because I may be a little more class conscious than your average conservative in a lot of ways. And the thing I've heard them complain about the most, except for the ones who are, you know, talking about the coming communist revolution in the world, who you just can't take seriously, but the other people, the number one item on their complaint list is paying off their college loans. And they're really, really upset about the fact that they went to college and someone lent them money to do that, and now they have to pay them back. And, you know, it's where I live in the South Bronx, I don't hear any of my neighbors complaining about their college loans because, you know, mostly they haven't gone to college, of course. And I think that if they had gone to college and hadn't had the money to do it and someone had lent them the money at concessionary rates and let them pay it back over 20 years or something like that, they would understand that this person had done them a favor and had not been, in fact, exploiting them or burdening them. So there's certainly an element of this kind of upper middle class entitlement mentality there that I think is distasteful to me, certainly. But the thing they're right about, and the thing that we should be concerned about, I think, as a country, is that, you know, real incomes for American men peaked in about 1970. Real median family incomes have stagnated or declined, depending on where you are in the distribution, for at least 10 years and probably more. Mm-hmm. There are some real serious challenges out there having to do with growth and employment and productivity and wages. Now, the fact that a bunch of jerks on Wall Street make big bonuses doesn't actually have anything to do with that. The nature of our economic problems isn't very much related to executive compensation or even to finance more broadly. You know, we didn't become poor because we had a financial crisis in 2008 and then a recession. But what that did was it revealed to us how far beyond our means we'd been living for a long time. You know, we had a decade in which the typical American family had been spending something close to 110% of its income, you know, using home equity and other sources of credit to extend their buying power well past where their wages were. And then when that all fell apart, kind of all at once, because of this magical thinking that residential real estate is a special commodity, the price of which can only go up and never comes down, and government and Wall Street and millions of homeowners all bought into that nonsense and are all paying the price for it. What happened with the financial crisis was that it pointed to a larger and broader and deeper crisis of longer standing, I think. And so these idiot punk kids down in Zuccotti Park, they feel that something is wrong, and they know that their standard of living is not as improving as quickly as their parents had in their generation or their grandparents. But to say, well, this is all Lloyd Blancpain's doing is, of course, nonsensical.
Right, right. Well, let me say a couple of comments on that. One, I understand, you know, obviously, I mean, protests tend to attract people who have time to protest, and that's very often likely to be younger and relatively better off people, so that the college loan is going to be the biggest, you know, the biggest personal thing. They're not, you know, if you're 22, you haven't personally bought a house and been foreclosed on. You know, you haven't been a victim of that dimension of it. But you also,
I'm not sure I like the word victim there when you're talking about foreclosures. You've done that a couple of times already, and if you take out a loan and you don't pay it.
Well, fair.
And the worst thing that happens to you is the word victim.
Lots of different circumstances lead to foreclosure. Yeah. If you take out a college loan, if you take out extensive loans for education, and it's certainly, you know, I don't know your neighbors, but it's certainly true that a lot of them have probably taken out loans for vocational training that did not lead to employment, and the same is true for a lot of college students today. So it's not, you know, there's not much to be grateful for in somebody lending you money for education if that education isn't actually resulting in any kind of payoff. And for lower income people, who, you know, people who went to the particularly the proprietary schools, it's likely to never lead to a payoff. Whereas for people who went to, you know, a 4-year college, it's likely to lead. It's going to be a deferred payoff. They're not
except for the people who got their, you know, BAs in feminist anthropology from Smith and have $200,000 in student loans and no conceivable source of occupation to pay them back.
Right, right. But part of that is, I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, you're no major is necessarily magic either. And you know, if you graduate from college in a recession, times are tough. On the other hand, you know, the unemployment rate for college graduates over 25 is still 4.2%. So you know, when the economy recovers somewhat, I think they'll probably be fine. But they're not fine now. So I think that's obviously legitimate. Their concern about student loans, that's the imminent thing in their lives, and I wouldn't really diminish that. The thing that interests me is that no, it's not necessarily Lloyd Blankfein's fault, but at the same time, a huge amount of economic inequality is in fact simply CEO pay. And, you know, I was looking at the top 1% numbers the other day, and we don't know exactly what happened to the top 1%. Since, like, the last definitive data we have is from 2008, mm-hmm. You know, where the top 1% share dipped somewhat. It dipped from about 23.5 to about 21% as a share of the total income in the country, which is one standard way of looking at inequality. And we don't know what happened since 2008, but we do know that, for example, CEO pay dipped in 2009 and went up 24% in 2010. And we also know that about half of the top 1% isn't hedge fund billionaires. It's simply CEOs.
Yeah.
Who are, you know, and other executives who are taking more and more, so they are directly linked.
Well,
the stagnation of wages here and the amount of money going to the top is directly related.
Yeah, now you've committed a logical blunder there, and I would like to actually address this a little bit because I think it's an important point for people to understand. You talk about the income of the top 1% did this, the income of the top 1% did that, and those numbers don't actually say what you think they say. Because if you want to talk about what happened to the income of people in the top 1% of households, what actually happened to those households, it doesn't match up to the numbers. What you get from these numbers from Treasury and IRS isn't what happened to the wealth or the incomes of actual people in those households. It is how much money you have to make to be in the top 1%. Because what happens is the number of people who are in the top, or the identity of the people who are in the top 1% or the top 1/10 of 1% or 1/100 of a percent is not the same from year to year. In fact, the turnover there is about 75% on a 10-year period. So if you run the numbers from 1996 through 2008, you'll find that the people who are in the highest income group that the IRS, or Treasury rather, tracks, only 25% of the ones who were there in 2006 were there in 1996 as well. So the ones who were the super wealthy in 1996, 75% of them.
Well, that's income.
I'm talking income here.
Income did this more slowly than income.
Well, of course it does. So, but these numbers don't actually tell you anything about what actually happened to people in those income brackets. Now, if you go and look at the IRS data, what you will find is that the income for those families on the median went down over those years. So the rich weren't actually getting richer if you look at what happens to the actual households of actual rich people. What you have is a statistical abstraction that means that the person in the top 1% in 2008 makes more money substantially than the person in the top 1% in 1988 did or 1998, which of course is exactly what you would expect. So these numbers that you hear thrown around a lot don't mean nearly as much as people seem to think that they do. We have tremendous amount of turnover.
I was not using the number of, you know, the median income within the top 1% or any of those numbers, which I don't think are that useful. And are largely, you know, we also don't have anything up to date on that either. You see the number 516,000 a lot. That's actually a projection that's used for tax modeling. The number I was talking about is the share of national income held by that top 1%, which certainly does change. Now, of course, if you say that it dropped, the number of, you know, people who were in the top 1% I guess you're using 1997 as your starting date. Those people aren't going to go beyond. There's no up for them to go. And
right.
Some of them did go down. Some of them retired. Some of them, you know, their sports careers ended. All kinds of things may have happened. But there's no way for their income not to drop. So it seems to me that's a logical fallacy on your part to say that that's more significant than looking at the share of total income held by the top 1%. And the fact that
what I object to in that is the idea that there are shares of income. Because there's not just this pot of income that gets shared out according to some formula or by the diktat of some authority. Income is not arbitrarily divided up by some method of public policy. So this whole idea that there is a national income is a kind of nonsensical abstraction, I think, in lots of ways. So you could have median income people, middle income people getting much better off, but people at the very high end getting even more better off.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that, actually.
But then, according to your tool of analysis here, that would result in more inequality, and therefore the world is in some way worse, which doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, and actually, Jamie Galbraith has actually written smartly about this, and there are times when you actually would, you know, late 90s, when you actually are close to full employment, and incomes are picking up in the middle and low ends. But you also have a tremendous jump in inequality, largely because of the tech boom. You have it, you know, very concentrated in a few zip codes, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a product of an actually growing dynamic economy, and you can see that people are doing better below, even though the share changes. That's a very different set of circumstances than the circumstances we're dealing with right now, where, you know, the bottom 20% is dropping, the second quintile is dropping somewhat, everybody above that is basically stagnant, and then the 1% is, you know, was shooting up in the boom and is back. It seems to be back on track in a way that it was not, for example, in the Great Depression. That's the circumstances we're talking about. I know, any economic statistic is misleading and problematic in its own way. I don't think that national income is some static pie, but it is a way of taking a snapshot of where things are going.
I think the mistake is to say, okay, well, we've got people in the bottom quintile whose incomes are declining, people in the second to bottom quintile whose incomes also are declining, people in the middle quintile whose incomes are stagnant, and then the top two are going up, but not nearly as much there at the top 1%.
Right.
But the mistake is to think that the fact that the people in the top 1% have incomes that are going up very quickly has anything to do with the fact that the people who are in the bottom 20 or 40% are seeing declines in stagnation.
Well, here I think that the prevalence of executives in the top 1% has a lot to do with it, because essentially, no, there's not a public policy decision, but there is a decision being made at a corporate level that says we've got to pay this guy $6.5 million this year, because, you know, they do this analysis of the comparable companies, and we've got to do this, and we also, in order to report profits to our shareholders, we really have to crack down as aggressively as possible on, you know, on low-end wages, on any possibility of unionization, and so forth. That is a choice. That's a decision that's being made. It's not a public policy decision. But there are certainly public policies that create certain, for example, tax treatment of options, things like that. There are certainly public policies that create some incentives there that lead to that choice being made.
Yeah, but you're talking about something here in which the really powerful factors are exogenous to policy. You know, the reason why...
Yeah, greed is an exogenous factor.
Well, no, it's not even that. Well, if you want to say that these poor Chinese and Indians who are trying to get 2,000 calories a day instead of 1,200 are greedy, then, yeah, you can try to make that argument, although I'm not sure that you're going to have a lot of success doing it. So what you've seen is
that wasn't at all anything.
Well, what you've seen is since the end of World War II, America no longer has its strange, unique position that it had right at the end of the war, where we had basically the whole free world's surviving manufacturing capacity. We had 80-odd percent of the world's manufacturing. But that's just because Europe and Japan were smoking ruins, of course, and they weren't building a lot of stuff, and their workforces had been literally decimated, and sometimes worse than decimated.
Right. I've written exactly that.
Right. Paragraph. So, yeah, as all sensible people have, although it never sinks in, right, for the rest of the world. So that's why, you know, you start to see the declines in men's incomes in around 1970, by the time that Europe really finally starts to catch up, and Japan and to a lesser extent South Korea and Taiwan and some other places really start to participate in the economy. So the thing that is, I think, seems to be a fairly good consensus among economists, that is tamping down the wages of Americans in the sort of middle class who had once upon a time access to these manufacturing jobs and other sorts of jobs in industrial capacities, is that they have a lot more competition now from foreign markets because of globalization and the integration of supply chains and such things, which will challenge their wages from here and until the end of time. And it's a fact. It's like the weather. And it's also one of the reasons why incomes are going up so much at the top. Because if you have, you know, even small marginal productivity gains for being a financial manager or a corporate executive or something like that, you know, if your whole world is Topeka, Kansas in 1955, then the income that your small productivity gains produces is relatively small. But if you have a market that is the whole world and you've got cash flows in the hundreds of billions of dollars a year, then you're going to produce very large incomes off of that. So it's the same dynamic, I think, is challenging incomes for the less productive, less educated, less skilled, lower income workers in this country, and inflating the incomes of people who have either great specializations like, you know, financial engineering, also other sorts of, you know, technology jobs and design work and those sorts of things, because simply of the integration of markets around the world. And there's nothing you can do in terms of public policy, passing a law, making a political wish list that's going to change that, nor should we want to change it, because it is making the world a better place. Although it's making the world a more challenging and difficult place for the American working class and the American middle class. You know, the main things we could do in terms of public policy to help them is, one, to fix our K-12 education system, which is an abomination and a nightmare and expensive and ineffective and a real disservice to the poor of this country, especially who don't have access to educational choices. And, of course, you know, it's Democrats standing in the way of that for the most part. You know, one of the first things Barack Obama did in office was try to kill the D.C. Hope Scholarship Program, which was the most successful school choice
which
benefited almost exclusively poor blacks.
Is pursuing policies that drive a lot of liberals crazy.
It's pursuing charters and
standards, and, you know, I'm actually all for it, but it's not the liberal agenda.
Well, it is to the extent that education in this country is conducted on the model of a public utility owned by the government. It's a government monopoly full of unionized government workers delivering a government subsidized product to people who are required by the government to be there. I mean, this is the model that the left wants. This is their model of governance. This is what the kids down on Occupy Wall Street want. They want the government to take over things, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, whether it's finance, so that it'll all perform as beautifully and efficiently as our public schools do.
Well, I don't want to totally get diverted into an education argument, although it seems to often happen with, you know, in conversations with conservatives or libertarians. You would still favor a public provision of education, right?
No, I favor the abolition of public schools. I want to close them down. I actually want to burn the buildings down.
Majority position. I mean, that's not something that is going to happen. So it's a question of how we provide a public something that is largely agreed as, you know, a merit good that we democratically choose to provide.
Where I think a distinction is helpful here is there's a big difference between the public provision of a good and the public funding of a good. You know, we have food stamps, for instance, which It's not a great program, but it basically gets done.
Wait, I'm sorry. Then we misunderstand each other. You favor public funding of education or not?
Well, I favor public funding of education as being preferable to public provision of education. So I'd rather have the government say, you know, here's your education voucher, go do what you will with it, and let schools compete in the marketplace the way grocery stores compete in the marketplace. You know, we've got food stamps, we don't have government-run farms and grocery stores, and that model works pretty well. Now, if you ask me in terms of, you know, my absolute preferences, no, I'd like to get the government entirely out of the education business, and every other business for that matter.
Okay. All right. I mean, you know, that's just it. I mean, I think, you know, D.C., I mean, I live in D.C., I have a child in D.C. public schools. The thriving success here is really the charter schools, far more influential, far more of a driving force for improvement of the whole system than the choice program was. And I think that's an important thing to recognize. And that
sure was popular with those parents who were benefiting from it. Maybe they know something about it you don't.
That may be.
So what next?
Well, you know, I did want to talk about the percentages a little bit, and and you've been writing a lot about tax reform, and I wanted to get into that a little bit. You wanted to talk about, you know, I think we kind of covered a little bit of this, of the concept of the 99% that's come out of Occupy Wall Street. We talked about that a little bit.
Yeah.
I have a piece coming out in the New Republic tomorrow, basically arguing that, you know, I number of people I think are kind of, I think one of the influences of Occupy Wall Street is we're shifting from my general approach to politics, and some people will call me a neoliberal. My general approach is to think, you know, the 80% that's doing fine, that we have the, you know, it's the 80% relatively well-educated, upper middle class, really have the larger obligation to the rest of the society, and our primary obligation is actually to the people who really have had the most trouble, and whether you provide that in forms of education, whatever form you provide it in, that's really where the obligation is. But I'm kind of moving, and the economist John Quiggin has written about this also on Crooked Timber, moving to kind of getting and appreciating the 99-to-1 analysis, because so that's something that I was interested in talking about a little bit, and you wanted to talk a little bit about the 53%, the sort of alternative approach to thinking about, you know, who's the winners. And
the 99-to-1 approach is rhetorically, of course, very intelligent, because if you're going to have a scapegoat or a villain or a party that you're going to demonize, you want to make it as small a population.
You want to make sure it's somebody else. It's somebody
possible.
Else.
And and that's, of course, the intelligent thing about the organizations behind Occupy Wall Street, which is by refusing to take a particular position on anything, they can pretend to stand for everything and be all things to all men. Once they actually have to decide that they're in favor of X, Y, and Z or opposed to X, Y, and Z, you can expect them, I think, to fall apart fairly quickly. But in response to this, we are the 99%. You saw this thing among conservatives as we are the 53%,
right,
which is a play on the fact that only 53% of Americans pay the federal income tax and 47% don't. And this is one of those things that, well, it happens about once a month. Something comes up in the conservative world that is just so boneheaded and wrong that it makes me want to go choke somebody. You know, I mean, you talk
well,
about
if you
it,
switch sides, you know, you're well aware there's some things like that on the other side too, so don't be tempted to
switch.
It's,
well, on your side, it's the 99%.
Yeah. Or my side of the ideological level.
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of a rhetorical strategy saying, well, screw you, 47% of the population. We're the taxpayers. You're the bums. Is kind of stupid anyway. But secondly, it's totally at odds with reality, which is, in fact, there are people who don't pay the federal income tax, yes, but they pay the payroll tax. They pay lots of other taxes. In fact, the poor pay disproportionately high taxes in a lot of situations. You know, if you're an upper-middle-class homeowner in Greenwich, Connecticut, with a $500,000 mortgage, you know, you're writing off that mortgage interest on your taxes and getting a really, you know, nice break on that. But if you're a renter in the Bronx, like me, for instance, you are paying your landlord's property taxes. You're not getting a tax benefit from it. In many jurisdictions, commercial properties are taxed at a higher rate than residential properties are. Certainly when you consider the tax benefits in, the rate's always higher for commercial properties. You know, the sales tax is an income tax on the poor because they consume basically 100% of their income. And it's just a silly, silly, boneheaded thing to do to say that, well, you know, these lucky so-and-sos who don't have to pay the federal income tax because they're just, you know, they're too low income, they're too poor to do it. So, you know, we conservatives, I think, need to be thinking about what we actually have to say to them about how we can do things to improve the condition of their lives rather than saying, well, you bastards ought to be paying the taxes.
Right, right. Well, it's always it is one of the great triumphs of conservatives and liberals, and not just Democrats and Republicans, but conservatives and liberals actually working together to begin to take get people off the tax rolls and to make work pay and so forth. It's, you know, it's a tremendous public policy success of the Reagan years and beyond. To do that with a huge amount of conservative support, so
Reagan was enormously proud of that fact.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think justifiably. Now, to me, it flashed up with the, when the lucky ducky concept popped up, which I think was in 2003 or something like that,
yeah,
in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
You know, the analysis at that time was, we would have a more, you know, that by letting all these people, by taking people off the tax rolls, you've lost an important constituency for anti-tax politics.
You know, which I think
if
is
they
true.
Were paying more, they'd be generally part of our tax revolt, which is a theoretical political argument. And, you know, most people aren't really that, you know, because, as you say, people really are paying those taxes. If there was a rebellion to happen, it wouldn't really matter whether it comes from the income tax or the payroll tax or anything else. But it wasn't really happening. So that's, I think, where the skin in the game concept comes from. It's not really an economic analysis. It's just a claim about politics.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, I think that claim is defensible. I mean, it's one of the things I like about flat taxes is that you get everybody essentially on the same side, and you take
right.
away the political class's ability to play these, you know, divide and conquer games with the tax code. But to present it as an argument that, you know, we are the taxpayers and you are the tax eaters, you know, we are the taxpayers and you are the bums, is just, it's not a political winner, I don't think, but it's also
right.
just at odds with economic reality.
Right. Well, let me test out an idea on you, which is that I think that one of the things that happened after, you know, in the late 2000s is that a lot of the culture war issues that had driven politics for a couple decades, crime, you know, reproductive rights, gun control, and so forth, gay marriage, for example, lost a lot of their potency. Not to say that people changed their positions, but they didn't have the same they didn't have that same effect with swing voters that they'd had for a while. You didn't have as many Democrats who could be targeted in districts where their constituencies were actually, you know, gun owners or so forth. You know, culture war issues lost some of their sway. And in place of that, what's happened over the last couple of years is to try to create a kind of culture war attitude about economics, which traditionally had been, you know, that's over on the technocratic side. People have people come at it from different viewpoints, but ultimately they work something out between, you know, the 1990 budget deal or whatever. Ultimately, economic choices get kind of we agree that there's a middle ground because they're not moral absolutes. But it seems to me that a lot of things have been happening now that are trying to recreate the feel and tone of culture war issues where there's really no compromise in the economic sphere. And 99-1 has an element of that, and so does 53% has that same aspect. Phil Graham, the former senator from Texas, used to talk about, you know, there's people pulling the wagon and there's people in the wagon, and the people in the wagon need to get out and start pulling. You know, which is, I mean, I think that's as flawed a conception of the economy as, certainly it's a lot more flawed than share of national income.
You know, that sort of thing is the reason why Phil Graham would have been a great president, and it's also the reason why Phil Graham was never president.
He would have been a great president. Why?
Oh, I think he had really useful, insightful things to say about economic policy and other things as well. And plus, he's from Texas, which is, of course, awesome. So, I think that there is a certain energy here of creating a kind of culture war issue around some economic ideas, particularly, you know, the Tea Party people feel this way about the debt and the deficit, as I do. and the 99%, the 53%, all the rest of it. And of course, in a sense, I'd like to encourage that sort of thing, because I do see it as a sort of us and them situation in a lot of ways, although I think a lot of people misunderstand who the us and the them is. You know, the enemy, as far as I'm concerned, is the, you know, is the permanent bureaucratic class, this, you know, class of professional parasites that is absolutely destroying the country financially.
You're talking about my neighbors.
Yeah, those people. those awful, awful, awful people. And, you know, even in these days we're talking about, oh, this, you know, horrible austerity and spending cuts and all this. You know, the state of New York has at least 50 school superintendents making more than $250,000 a year. Now, I can see that in New York City, maybe, or a couple of other big cities. But, you know, you run out of big cities pretty quick in the state of New York. You've got people like the city manager in Lubbock, Texas, where I'm from, is paid more than $200,000 a year. You've got school superintendents in towns of fewer than 100,000 people pulling in close to $300,000 a year. And then you've got places like Topeka, Kansas, saying, well, we can't afford to prosecute domestic violence cases anymore, but we're going to spend $500,000 a year on the performing arts and the three, count them, three publicly subsidized theater troupes operating in Topeka, Kansas, which, of course, is, you know, known as the center of the dramatic universe. So I understand why they'd want to have all that theater down there. But, you know, you're making specific decisions. Well, we're going to spend money on publicly subsidized theater troops. We're not going to prosecute cases where women have been beaten half to death with crowbars and thrown through windows, as was the case in one situation down there in Topeka. So, you know, you've got a gross misallocation of resources across the board in almost every government agency, from the Pentagon to your local public schools. And, you know, that's the enemy as far as I'm concerned. You know, I would like there to be a sort of more outraged, angry sort of movement to identify and shame and hopefully make unemployed a great number of these people.
Okay. But that's not going to, I mean, that's even less likely to change the economic circumstances.
I disagree. You know, our greatest, I think, our greatest single economic threat right now is public debt. You've got, you know, a national federal debt that is enormous and unsustainable and getting worse every year. We spent more money this year than we did last year, to the tune of about $200 trillion. You've got 27 states, at least, that can't afford to make their pension payments for their government retirees in the next couple of years. You've got another $2 or $3 trillion worth of state and local debt on top of that. And then you add in, you know, the unfunded liabilities for the national entitlements, and you're talking about an astronomical number. And if you have a California or an Illinois or a New Jersey or something like that become insolvent, which is a very likely possibility, you're talking about throwing the country into a recession the likes of which we haven't seen.
Right, but simply, you know, cutting the pay of school superintendents in upstate New York, or, you know, cutting the subsidy for a theater program in Topeka, Kansas, doesn't even begin to make a dent in either the state fiscal picture or obviously the federal debt.
Well, it does for the states and locals, because, you know, almost all their expenses are personnel, and the big drivers of their expenses are retirement and health care benefits. Now, in the federal picture, of course, you have to reform Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and defense spending, because that's pretty much the whole budget,
right.
You know, those things. And this is where presidential politics drives me crazy, because everyone says, well, we want to balance the budget, and we want to cut some taxes, and we're never going to touch defense spending because we're Republicans, and we're never going to touch Social Security because we're cowards, and we're not going to touch Medicare because we don't want to do that either, and old people vote, so that leaves Medicaid and, you know, things like, oh, foreign aid, which comes to a few billion dollars a year, which
right.
is, you know, nothing.
Which ultimately in office they don't actually cut either.
Right, and no one ever cuts anything.
It's a pretty important tool of what a president does.
Yeah, it's
you know, I think anything. You should substitute. I think you should say this is where Republican presidential politics drives me crazy. Drives you crazy.
Well, I don't see any Democrats out there saying, well, we're gonna reform Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, and I don't really even see very many Democrats saying we're gonna cut defense spending, and I've certainly never seen one
right.
do it.
Right.
I mean, I think there's a...
Well, I'll take that back. We did cut defense spending during the Clinton years. I correct myself.
Though. Yeah, we did cut. We also cut Medicare substantially during the Clinton years. You want to cut Medicare, elect Democrats. And, you know, Obama's cut Medicare significantly and, you know, certainly was prepared to raise the Medicare eligibility age.
Yeah,
which is where you lose even me, you know?
Yeah. And I definitely hope that happens, although, you know, the sorts of really broad and deep reforms of these entitlements that are going to happen just simply aren't on the table for either party. And they won't be until, you know, we're forced into it by some sort of monetary and or fiscal crisis, which will probably happen within the next few years.
Okay. Well, I disagree. I mean, I think obviously you can make relatively modest changes to Social Security. And changes to Medicare require changes in the way we handle health care. They don't require, the Ryan plan is not a way to make the costs go down. It's a way to cut people out.
Which amounts to the same thing, though, doesn't it? I mean, that's the way you make costs go down. I mean, it's the way Obamacare envisions getting costs down. It's the way almost every plan envisions doing that because
right. it's very different in the world of people over 65 than it is in a pool that has a lot of healthy people as well as unhealthy people to make that insurance market work.
Yeah, except for we've totally changed our conception of what insurance is because now we're saying, well, insurance has to insure against things that have already happened, which we call pre-existing conditions. So we've created this weird sort of, you know, epistemological thing. If you're making a bet on events in the past, as though we have some sort of, you know, time travel machine to go back and forth, you know, insurance is by its nature prospective, and now we're making it retrospective.
Right. Well,
this is a really good example.
Single system, you know, the VA doesn't have that problem because everything is under it. If people weren't switching insurances with their employers all the time, you wouldn't have a problem with pre-existing.
Well, yes, the attachment of health coverage to the workplace, of course, is bad, and it's a result of earlier attempts at rational economic planning, which always produce the same failed results. So what you're arguing for, then, is a monopoly there, then? A single system, is that what you're asking for?
No, I'm not arguing for
anything. And what other aspects of life do you think a monopoly is a sensible arrangement?
I think that there can be situations where a unified system is valuable. I don't think it's necessarily a monopoly. I mean, government holds a monopoly on, you know, what is the definition of the state? Monopoly on the use of coercion. I think national defense is a good thing to have a monopoly in.
Police
protection is a good thing to have a monopoly in. And I think that the most efficient healthcare system is going to be the one that has the broadest possible coverage. I think it's, you know,
why doesn't that model produce the most efficient education system? Or the most efficient
Well, it probably does system. Produce a fairly efficient education system. It may not
be nonsense. Nonsense. I mean, look at we are now spending in real dollars twice what we spent on education 25 years ago.
Right.
We're not getting twice the results. In fact, we're getting mediocrity at best and declines in lots of places. Don't tell me that's an efficient system. Don't tell me that makes any sense.
I think I think there's a lot of improvements in American education, and I think it's a fairly efficient, you know, it's an efficient allocation of the resources we put into education, I think a real voucher system that got people the same value that they're getting now would be a more expensive system.
Well, yeah, I think that a voucher system would certainly be an improvement, but you know,
three out of ten American men
is functionally illiterate. I mean, that's the measure of the effectiveness of our education system.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
3 out of 10 American men are functionally illiterate, and that's
the
measure.
That obviously includes people who are educated in a different era as well as today.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we've had government monopoly schools for a long time, and I expect government monopoly health care or government quasi-monopoly health care to produce similar results.
Well, we'll see. We'll
find out.
You know, you're arguing an entire hypothetical where there is no government role in providing education, and you're arguing that it would be both more efficient and would produce better results, in which you didn't have 3 out of 10 men being illiterate. That's an empirical state. I don't know the answer to that.
But we have lots of examples to guide us. We have lots of examples of market-provided goods and services and lots of examples of socially-provided goods and services. And the differences between them in terms of innovation, efficiency, the cost curve, accessibility, and all the rest of it, you know, they're very broad, predictable trends in these things. There's a reason why cell phones get better and cheaper every year and schools suck.
Okay, I don't think my schools suck. I think that I think we have a lot of examples of different kinds of things because there's a lot of different things that where different ways of providing it work better than others. And I love markets. I'm totally for markets. I think there if we democratically agree, we want to make sure that every kid has a K through 12 education that meets a certain basic standard. There need to be public schools. They don't need to be the only kind of schools. And charter schools are a huge, huge, awesome innovation. And there may be a role for both public sector choice and private sector choice as a way of getting some energy into the system, getting some of the power of competition. But it's not, you know, I don't think if it were the only thing we had going that you would get the better results. That's not because I love public sector, you know, not because I ideologically am more attached to that than the other, but I think, you know, it gets a lot of value. It gets a lot of value in most of the countries of the world. I don't know that there's a country in which K-12 education is entirely privatized.
No, I don't know about either.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll find one.
So if you look at international comparisons, it's not like you're saying this, you know, it's not like you're saying Japan does better because they've got a different structure of competition in their schools.
No, I'm saying Apple does better because they provide their products in the marketplace, whereas public schools provide them through social means with no competition and no accountability.
Right, but they're doing totally different things, and Apple is only, you know, even Apple, only, you know, Apple can make a gazillion dollars with 30% of the market share.
Yeah, I think that public school, public education, education in general is a consumer good. I think that healthcare is a consumer good. You know, there's a fairly narrow set of things that are true public goods, which are difficult to provide through markets because they're not excludable and they're non-rivalrous, you know. So you've got things like, you know, it's hard to build a private sector missile defense network or courts or, you know, police departments or things like that. Education is not one of those things, and healthcare is not one of those things. We've had markets in these for a long time. We know how to deliver those sorts of goods and services.
And, of course, we have markets in education. It's called real estate, you know. If you have kids, you're probably not going to stay in the South Bronx. You're going to make a market choice to go to Ridgewood, New Jersey.
And that, to me, is really the liberal worldview encapsulated, because it's true you have choice in real estate if you're an upper-middle class.
Well, sure, I know, I totally acknowledge that.
Poor people don't have those choices.
Absolutely.
But, you're sort of managerial class liberals generalize their own way of living to the entire population, and they think, well, if other people lived like we did, then they would be happy like we are.
And no, I'm not saying that, and I don't live like that myself. What I'm saying is that, you know, it's not like there aren't market choices that people make in education, and those market choices have an impact that has actually made education worse.
Mm. I think that you're looking at a, you know, sort of a third-hand market choice there, because people don't actually say, I will pay you X for education Y. I mean, that's a market transaction. What you've secondary, tertiary.
But especially if you look like a place like New Jersey, which has, I think it has 360 school districts. Mm-hmm. Those are essentially product lines, you know, which come at different prices.
Yeah.
The lower the price, the less valuable the good.
Yeah. Well, no, that's not true at all. I don't think people tend to like lower prices and they tend to value them. So what should we?
The cheaper you would, if you move to New Jersey, the cheaper the house you buy, the less good education you're going to be buying.
Yeah, it seems likely. Sure. Okay, I'm not gonna argue that one. Of course, New Jersey. Yeah. What can you say?
I worked for the senator from New Jersey for a long time, so I'm a little more familiar with that.
Yeah, actually, it seems like a perfectly lovely state.
It's a very lovely state. It's the Garden State. But it has an enormous amount of educational inequality within it.
Yeah.
Huge improvements, actually, in urban education, driven by an active government. Huge improvements. Mm. But huge inequalities as well.
Yeah.
Legendary inequalities.
We'll see how that works out. Should we touch on anything else, or I know you need to go
soon. Maybe we should. I think we've touched all the major areas of liberal-conservative conflict without actually venturing into any culture war issues, so I think we should just... a well done blogging heads.
So abortion next time then. All right.
Yeah. All right. Take care, Kevin. Nice to talk to you.
You're good.
Bye-bye.